WKOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri's source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. Happy New Year, it's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Everybody, good morning to you, wherever you may be as you listen to this radio program. It is Radio Orbit, My name is Mike Hagan, and it's good to be with you here on this Happy New Year, 1st of January, 2007. All right, got things going there with a little bit of music from Soul Valor. Soul Valor, that's Mindscape Matter. We'll hear more from Soul Valor throughout the program tonight. Wonderful, interesting, experimental, ambient, electronic, alternative music. Independent as well. Always on Radio Orbit, bringing good music to you, an interesting conversation. We'll do it again tonight. We've got Rick Levine, our friend Rick Levine, an amazing and interesting astrologer. We'll be talking about 2007, what we've got to look forward to. Maybe take a little look back as well at 2006 and see how things shaped up last year. But before we get going, let's do our quick thank yous out there to Debbie Johnson. As always, wonderful stuff. Free Range Radio Theater, 10 p.m. until 11, just an hour before this program. Free Range Radio starts every Monday at 10 o'clock and sets things up nicely for Radio Orbit. Debbie Johnson doing wonderful stuff as always. Tonight, The Apocalypse of Bill Lizard, or was it Bill Lizard's Apocalypse? Anyway, interesting radio as always from Debbie Johnson. She'll do it again next week. And every week at 10 p.m. on Monday, all right, just before this program. Before her, Kelvin and Jason doing it up. Jazz plus blues equals New Year's mayhem. Tech Radio always helping us out with our technological issues and teaching us things about the world we live in. Jeff Wheeler, Uncommon Light, starting things off from 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Great radio on KLPN. And as always, I'm glad to be a part of it. All right, thanks to everybody who participated and listened to the program last week. Of course, thanks to Jan Irvin and Andrew Rutaji for their time and talk, taking Christmas night off to talk about Christmas, as a matter of fact, the mysteries of Christmas unraveled before your ears last week. Amazing stuff. If you missed it, it's on the web, www.mikehagan.com, and just click on over to the program archives, right? You can download last week's program. Or any other program that we've done in the last few years here, okay? All right, tonight, as I said, New Year's. Rick Levine with us in just a little while at top of the hour. Rick normally talks with us from the Seattle area, but he's out on the East Coast tonight. Maybe not the East Coast, but Eastern Seaboard. I think Atlanta, somewhere in Georgia. But we'll speak with Rick in about 50 minutes or so. And again, we'll talk about the stars and astrology and what Rick sees coming for us up in 2007. You know, Rick's all over the place. If you go and Google his name, he's quite popular these days. A whole bunch of different websites and other organizations are putting their name on his material and sharing it with other people. If you remember, Rick was on the program just briefly with Jay Widener just a couple weeks ago. And John Jenkins was on the program with us then as well. I've got some news, actually, from John Jenkins that I'll share with you in just a little while here when we get maybe to space weather or later during this first hour of the program. But I got a wonderful email from him from Mexico just a few days ago. Anyway, I've got a bunch of stuff to talk about tonight on New Year's, so we'll do it. All right. We also have the music of Soul Valor, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago. It's a musical project, basically a one-man project. A friend of mine who we've come to know through the website, his name is Dennis Thielman, wonderful musician, and this particular project of his goes by the name of Soul Valor. And we started things off there, as I said, with a song that was called Mindscape Matter. We'll play more from Dennis throughout the program tonight, okay? All right, hello to everybody listening, whether you're listening over the traditional airwaves on KOPN in mid-Missouri. Hello to you, and also if you listen to the program via the internet, via Cosmic Waves Radio. We do it every week, live, on the air, and on the web. And thanks to KOPN and Cosmic Waves for making it happen every Monday night. All right. On the web, if you are looking for that live stream, you can do that at www.cosmicwavesradio.com. And, of course, KOPN on the web, kopn.org. Thanks to everybody at both of those wonderful institutions that make the show happen every week, okay? Also, if we're saying thank you to everybody, which we are, and I should say a lot of thank yous, it's the beginning of a new year, but certainly at the top of that list is Larry Norringer, the wonderful web wizard, as always, helping us out with the internet side of things for the radio program. Again, if you want to see what Larry's up to, just go over to www.mikehagan.com. He's always making me proud and doing wonderful work on the web, and he's got all kinds of other things that he does as well. He's an amazing musician, and he, well, let's just say he juggles a lot of balls and keeps them all in the air, and he's been just a great friend and a wonderful addition to the radio orbit, you know, scene. Without him, couldn't do any of the stuff that we do on the internet. And if you go over there to the site, you'll see what I'm saying. Just more and more stuff all the time, and I thank him for it. All right? Okay, like I said, if you want to check it out, let me know what you think. You can go over there. It's easy to get a hold of me and take a look. Let us know what you think. The forum, by the way, has been busy. I'd like to say welcome to all the new members that have been participating and sharing stories and insights and ideas with us. Lots of interesting topics being discussed over there every day now. And as well, we've got a live chat room up and active tonight. Haven't peeked in there yet, sort of under the gun tonight. A little bit under the weather. I tell you, it's been a rough winter for me. You know, I'm always doing my best to try to stay in shape and take good care of my health. And regardless, this winter has just gotten the best of me for some reason. And the most recent, I have like a toothache. It's just been driving me crazy for the last few days, and you know, got to get that taken care of. So anyway, I tried to get a little rest before the program tonight, and wasn't able to do a whole lot of checking things out on the web before I came on the air here, because I was sort of under the gun. So at any rate, the live chat is up and active, and the stream is out there, so I'm sure people are listening, and we'll be peeking in there for questions and comments as we get moving tonight. I encourage all the guests and listeners as well to join us in the chat room and in the forum. Anytime. It's always a great place to visit with other people and see what's on their minds as well. Okay. Okay. If you want to get a hold of me and let me know what's on your mind, the email address that you can reach me at all the time is orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. On the web, www.mikehagan.com, as I said. And I think we'll leave it at that for a few minutes here. We'll take another break. I'll get my act together, and we'll come back and, well, I can tell you, I've got a few things to bring you up to speed on, some announcements I need to make. We'll talk about some upcoming guests. We've got space weather to do, a little bit of news if we have the time, and then Rick Levine at the top of the hour, okay? All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, and this is Soul Valor. The song is called Is It Haunting You? Back in just a few minutes. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. Thank you. it haunting you? All right, wonderful music again. That's Soul Valor on KOPN Radio Orbit. It's Mike. You're listening to it here about 20 minutes after the hour of 11 p.m. on the 1st of January. Happy New Year to everybody out there. 2007. Can you believe it? Man, oh man, it goes so fast these days. The time. I was talking with some friends about just years past in the last few days and about how quickly time has passed. You know, we've talked about the year 2000. We talked about, you know, some dates in the past that sort of were significant and how quickly they've gone by. I mean, the year 2000, I remember the ringing in of the new year 7 years ago, but boy, sure, it doesn't seem like that long ago to me. It seems like time just moving ever faster and faster and faster, and no reason to seem to think that that's going to let up. Of course, there are people that have ideas, you know, about what's really happening with regard to time and that sort of stuff. We'll talk with one of them at the top of the hour, Rick Levine. I'm certainly interested in time and the different things that happen over different periods of time. You know, we have this idea that time is linear, that, you know, it doesn't really affect anything. It just sort of goes along. But, you know, the idea that time is more of a dynamic parameter in which we sort of swim in is becoming more and more, you know, a more and more reasonable argument. The idea that time actually isn't linear, that things change, and experiments and life and the things that happen throughout time are not independent of the time in which they occur. You know, they are time dependent. And we're seeing that more and more as we move forward toward, toward whatever the future brings. Anyway, Rick Levine, in just a few minutes here, actually about 40 minutes or so at the top of the hour. Let's talk about upcoming guests, actually, since we just mentioned Rick. We've got Stephen Buhner, my good friend and, just one of the most amazing people I've ever met. Stephen Buhner, just a remarkable human being, an amazing herbalist, a healer, a great writer, the author of, 10 or 12 different books. I'm reading a book right now called Sacred Plant Medicine that Stephen wrote in 1995, some 11, 12 years ago. But it's the right time for me to read it, that's for sure. You know, sometimes you have to read a book at the right time. Speaking of time, you know, you can read it at the wrong time and it might not mean, well, let's just say it will mean something different to you than if you read it at another time. And certain books, certain music, certain radio programs, certain interviews that you hear, whatever, they all sort of come together. And if it's at the right time, it can be something really profound, really significant, and even life-changing. And I've had that happen I don't know how many times, you know, over the last 25 years of my life. But certainly these are time-dependent things, again. And the stuff that I've come across from Stephen Herod Buhner has been at a time in my life when I really needed to come across it, and he's just remarkable. And I recorded some material with him a few weeks ago. We'll air that on the program next week. On the 8th of January, Stephen Herod Buhner. And we'll also introduce some great new music from Yachai. You know, I haven't mentioned my friends Jeff and William from Yachai in a while, and haven't played any of their music in a little while either. We've had so much other stuff going on. But we'll feature the music of Yachai next week. They've got all kinds of new stuff out. I just got another single released in my email box yesterday or today. And they're right in the middle of this project that's being called the Insect Sessions. And some really interesting music inspired by the shamans of South America. And Jeff and William, the guys from Yachai, will help them on the program next week and listen to their music throughout the program as well with Stephen Herod Buhner, okay? On the 15th of January, Dr. Kevin Warwick. Kevin Warwick is a professor at Reading University in the UK, and he's been in the middle of a lot of controversy for some time now. He's interested in human enhancement. It's one of the ways they describe the work that Kevin Warwick is interested in and involved in. But it's basically cybernetics, you know, technological implants and enhancements and things like that to the human body, brain chips and all kinds of stuff. And it's real sketchy stuff. And there are a lot of people that that aren't at all interested in or happy with what Kevin Warwick and the people that are working on this stuff are doing. And I've had some emails, as a matter of fact, to say, why are you going to waste your time talking to this guy? He's a front man, you know, for the NWO, and they're, you know, they have an agenda to implant us all with chips and control our minds and this and that. And I recognize, you know, that this is certainly one application that could be used with this technology. But I'm not particularly paranoid with regard to overarching conspiracy theory. I know conspiracies exist. Certainly they do. There are lots of different gangs and cabals and secret societies and, you know, individuals vying for power and will go to great lengths. In many cases, will do anything, including take human life and life of other creatures, you know, in order to achieve their goals. I'm just not one that believes that there's one overarching conspiracy that's actually in charge of everything, that someone's actually running the show. And, you know, if people want to worry about the technological side of people like that, you know, what they might do with technology, well, I recognize it as valid. But I also see it as, you know, dual, like most things, or all things at least, all things that I've come across. You know, there are two sides to all these coins, and certainly the technology may be used in beneficial manners, may be used in ways that we can't even, you know, fathom right now because it's still too far over the horizon. But, you know, regardless of where you stand on the whole human enhancement, technological implantation, neurological, you know, cyborg building business, it's all this stuff is happening, so we got to sort of deal with it. And I figure might as well talk to the guy who's right in the middle of it and you know, and see what he has to say. And if there are tough questions that you want me to put toward him, you know, send them to me beforehand in email or whatever, and I'll do my best to, you know, to address people's issues. I don't know, you know, what else I can say other than that. But it's interesting stuff, and we're going to have Kevin Warwick, Dr. Kevin Warwick, on the air with us on the 15th of January and let him sort of air out what he thinks about the whole business, okay? All right, on the 22nd of January, Star and Michael will be back on the program. Star Newland, of course, and Dr. Michael Heisen, our wonderful cetacea people out there in Hawaii, doing wonderful work. Michael's actually been doing some work with Nassim Haramein at the Resonance Foundation or the Resonance Institute. And very interesting information that is coming out of there. So we'll be getting some updates from Michael and from Star in a few weeks on the 22nd of January. And, of course, that program will roll over into the 23rd. We did that on purpose because, you know, Star likes to do the 1-2-3 thing. So we'll do it with Star and Michael Heisen on the 22nd of January. We'll talk about dolphins and space flight and lots of other things. All right, what else? Paul Laffoley, an amazing visionary artist. Haven't quite nailed down a date with Mr. Laffoley, but we'll have him sometime in the next couple months, probably maybe more toward the spring than the winter, but really looking forward to that program. Dale Pendel, another great program that I'm looking forward to that we have to still solidify the dates on. My good friend Jim Beard and Patrick Flanagan. Talk about some alternative energy ideas. Going to do a little bit more of that in 2007. There's a whole lot going on in all these different areas. So, you know, I always welcome people to suggest guests as well because oftentimes guests that I have on the program are people that I was turned on to from listeners like you. You know, everybody's into different stuff, and you can't be up on everything. And so what you do is, collect and gather information and then try to sift through it, and that way you can try to get the best and most appropriate guests for the program and the guests that the audience out there likes to hear. So, feel free to send me notes or whatever if you come across people that you think might be good to have on the program, okay? All right, we've got a lot of great stuff coming up in 2007. I'm very excited about what's happening with the radio show and just what's happening with the world in general. I think it's an amazing time to be alive. Yeah, there's lots of spooky, scary nastiness going on, but there's also absolutely astonishing and remarkable, beautiful, wonderful things happening at the same time. They may not be as apparent in the, cultural melee, but they're there nonetheless, and if you want to be a part of them, you just got to get in and do it. And so that's what we're going to try to do more and more of this year on the radio program, and I thank everybody out there for listening over the last year. I want to thank everyone, all the people that have, contributed to the program. Thank my family and the station, all my friends, all the great people in my life who have made me what I am and given me the opportunity to do this stuff. So anyway, I love you all. Thanks so much for everything. And we're going to do it up this year. Trust me. All right, let's see. It's about 11:30. Let's talk a little bit more. Maybe we can do space weather here. And I've got a couple things that I'll mention after space weather. Some announcements. And we'll do that before we play any more music, okay? All right, Aurora Watch. Keep your eyes out. If you're up there in the north, the Earth is entering a pretty intense solar wind stream. The encounter could cause some mild geomagnetic storms. And if you're up there in the north, you should be watching for Aurora Borealis. Over the last couple weeks, there's been just amazing displays of aurora in the northern hemispheres, and lots of great imagery on the web over at cyberspaceorbit.com. You can check out Kent's site, who's back up, by the way, after having a difficult time over the last week. I don't know if it was a solar storm combined with hacking or whatever, but anyway, regardless, Kent is back up and running, even if it's in a sort of reduced capacity right now. I know he's got a lot of computer issues, but they're getting it back together over there in the cave in Seattle where Kent Stedman does all his work, okay? Anyway, amazing Aurora Borealis, and if you look at the website spaceweather.com, you can see some great imagery of this stuff as well. Happy New Year. This morning, one of the first things that you saw if you were looking at the sun with a telescope, you see our old friend Sunspot 930. This is a area of intense activity on the sun that about 2 weeks ago unleashed four gigantic X-class flares that sparked those intense auroras that I was just talking about, and did all kinds of other things. Wreaked havoc with lots of communication satellites and did a whole bunch of stuff up there in the sky above your heads. For the past couple weeks, the sunspot has been transiting the backside, the far side of the sun, out of sight to earthly viewers. But now it's back, rotating around to the front side of the disk, and it's still big. And it looks like it's a little bit more stable this time around, the magnetic field that surrounds this particular region of the sun. But you never know. That thing is still quite active and, could start to do its business again anytime. So we'll keep an eye on that. Let's see. Well, today, the 1st of January, begins what is being called the International Lunar Decade. Now, this is a riot, all right? The International Lunar Decade. I'm not sure. This is a PR move, basically, from NASA and, I don't know who else is involved in it. There's an organization called the Planetary Society. I'm sure that they're somehow tied to NASA or whatever. But anyway, they're making a big deal about what an extraordinary time this is for lunar exploration. Talking about missions that are developing in China, Japan, in India, and again in the United States and Italy and Europe in general. And they're talking about what a wonderful time it is to study the moon. Anyway, for what it's worth, welcome to the International Lunar Decade. I thought it was the 1960s, but apparently it's the 2007 to 2017, 50 years late. All right, January 2nd. Got your usual comets and asteroids whizzing by. A comet named Siding Spring, as a matter of fact, going to reach perihelion tomorrow, getting close to the sun, not too far away from our planet, as a matter of fact. What else? Earth, actually, at perihelion with the sun on the 3rd of January. What that means is perihelion means it's as close to the sun as it ever gets. And we say this about anything that's in orbit around a star, comets and asteroids, but in our case now we're talking about our planet. The Earth will be at perihelion on the 3rd of January, and it's about 0.98 astronomical units from the sun. One astronomical unit is sort of an arbitrary measurement, but it's been determined to be the distance, the average distance between the sun and the Earth, and that's typically about 93 million miles. When Earth is at perihelion, it's at a somewhat shorter distance from the sun. Not quite 93 million miles, more like 90 million miles. So the Earth isn't always the exact same distance away from our star. And it's interesting because in the northern hemisphere here, we're in the middle of winter. And being in the middle of winter, one might not consider the fact that we're actually closer to the sun than we are in summertime. So it's not really an issue of distance between the planet and the sun, but it has to do with the angle of incidence of the sun's rays, because our planet is at an angle, it doesn't spin, you know, directly vertically on its axis. It has about a 20 degree tilt in the axis. Well, you get different angles of incidence of the sun's rays at different times during the year. So actually in the wintertime in the northern hemisphere, the Earth is actually quite close to the sun, even though it's cold. All right, what else? The Quadrantids meteor shower is going to peak on the 3rd as well. This is a meteor shower that you'll be able to see if you go outside in the late night and early morning hours of January 3rd and 4th. And look to the north, northeast, and locate the Big Dipper up there in the sky. If you see the Big Dipper, the bright star that's at the end of the Big Dipper, not the handle end, but back at the dipper end, that's those two stars there that make up that tail end of the Big Dipper will point over to Polaris. And if you use those two sort of guideposts in the sky, the Big Dipper and Polaris, the North Star, just look directly below those two, and that's the area from which the Quadrantid meteor shower should be radiating. And you might see some interesting things in the sky over the next few nights. All right. Okay, what else? January 4th, Wilhelm Beer's 210th birthday. He was, Beer was sort of an amateur astronomer, but he built a private observatory. He was a German guy, and he built an observatory in Berlin back in the early 1800s, and with a guy named Johann Heinrich Mädler, he produced the first pretty accurate map of the moon. And this was done in 1835 or 1836, something like that, and they did this amazing description of the moon that hadn't been done. Both the description of the moon, and they also did a description of Mars. They created the first globe of the planet Mars in the late 1830s. But both of these remained the best descriptions of the moon and Mars for some decades to come. So anyway, Wilhelm Beer would have been 210 years old this coming January 4th. All right, the 5th and 6th, we have the Colloquium on Evolution and Exploration of Solar Systems. That's in Irvine, California. What else? January 5th through the 10th, the 209th meeting of the American Astronomical Society. And on the 6th of January, Deep Impact. It's a mission out there that smashed into a comet, if you remember. Was it last year, the year before? We'll be doing a Mars flyby in just a couple of days. Okay? All right, let's see. I think that I'll play a piece of music here. And got a nice little poem that I came across earlier today in a synchronistic sort of way. So I think I'll read that over this music from Soul Valor. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about a couple things in the news. And I've got a few things to share with you just that I've come across in the last week or so, okay? All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And this is called Cosmogenesis, Part 1. Wild bells to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light, the year is dying in the night. Ring out wild bells and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new, ring happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go, ring out the false, ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind. For those that hear, we see no more. Ring out the feud of rich and poor. Ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer laws. Ring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. Ring out false pride in place and blood, the civic slander and the spite. Ring in the love of truth and right. Ring in the common love of good. Ring out old shapes of foul disease. Ring out the narrowing lust of gold. Ring out the thousand wars of old. Ring in the thousand years of peace. Ring in the valiant man and free, the larger heart, the kindlier hand. Ring out the darkness of the land. Ring in the Christ that is to be. Thank you. Cosmogenesis, Part 1. Great music from Soul Valor. Thanks to Dennis Thielman for making this great music that we're sharing tonight. And thanks to Alfred Lord Tennyson for writing the poem called Ring Out Wild Bells, which I read at the beginning of that piece, Cosmogenesis, Part 1, okay? All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Let me take care of a little bit of business here. KOPN invites you to the annual potluck celebration, Sunday, the 21st of January, at the Unity Center, 1600 West Broadway. Doors will open at 3:30 p.m., and you'll get a report on the state of the station, what's happening here at KOPN, recognition of the stars here at the station, and the Board of Directors election results will start at 4 p.m. sharp, followed by a potluck dinner with entertainment and fun, socializing the whole bit. All right, call KOPN at 874-1139 during normal business hours for more information, and you can find lots of information, of course, about KOPN and everything that we're up to here at the website www.kopn.org. All right, it's Mike, and you are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. That was an Alfred Lord Tennyson poem called Ring Out Wild Bells. And I also need to mention, I read something last week by Christopher Fry that was called A Sleep of Prisoners. I read that over one of the ITOM Lab songs, and thanks to them last week, by the way, for the wonderful music. But I read this thing by Christopher Fry called A Sleep of Prisoners, and I didn't mention it, the name of it, last week, and a couple people asked what it was, so that's what it was. It was written by Christopher Fry, and it's called A Sleep of Prisoners. All right? All right, let's see. We got about 14 minutes before the top of the hour. We've got Rick Levine going to be spending the next couple hours with us from somewhere on the eastern seaboard. Normally, like I say, we talk to Rick from the West Coast, but he's staying up late for us tonight and going to talk about the new year and the old year and the years to come. A few things before then. As I mentioned, Kent Stedman, www.cyberspaceorbit.com. Kent's back up and got his website and computer situation at least partially resolved, so you can always find out what's up in his world on the web at cyberspaceorbit.com. And you can link there directly from my site always, but Kent's doing great work and always has been, at least ever since I've known him, and had a real difficult time last week, but got things back together. So if you haven't been over there for a while, zip on back over to Orbit and say hi to Kent, okay? All right, welcome to all the new members over at the forum and at my website. Lots of new people joining, and I appreciate it. Wonderful to have you there participating and contributing. Let's see, what else did I want to mention to you before the top of the hour here? John Lilly, the wonderful Dr. John Lilly, his birthday would be on the 6th of January. John Lilly, of course, the amazing biologist who worked with dolphins and whales in the 50s and 60s, and had just an amazing career and was one of the inspirations and teachers of our friend Dr. Michael Heisen and Star Newland, who run the Sirius Institute out there in Hawaii, again working with our dolphin and whale pals out there in the ocean. And John Lilly was just a remarkable individual and someone who I consider to be an inspirational person who I ran across in my life. So anyway, his birthday is the 6th of January, 1915, he was born. He would have been 92 years old in just a few days. And another one of my heroes, whose name was Nikola Tesla, died on the 7th of January in 1943. And Nikola Tesla, of course, another one of these remarkable individuals who has yet to be recognized for the genius of his work. You know, you hear Tesla's name here and there associated with things like, you know, AC power and you know, the Tesla Tower and some sort of novel things, and they talk a little bit about his work with radio. Marconi got credit for so much of Tesla's work, but the great majority of Tesla's work has never been discussed by anyone in the mainstream. He was absolutely remarkable, and some of the work that he did could be of great use to us today. You know, it's amazing how many things were developed 100 years ago that have been in the closet, and we've yet to you know, to benefit from discoveries that were made a long, long time ago, primarily because of you know, government, business, political reasons. Not for anything other than that. You know, Tesla was funded by J.P. Morgan. And one of the ideas that Nikola Tesla had, that he had made great progress on, was the wireless distribution of energy, the wireless distribution of electricity. And he did this basically just using the Earth. Tesla realized that the Earth was essentially a gigantic capacitor, and he had figured out a way where he could generate electricity basically through the Earth. And he went to Morgan and said, hey, I got this great idea. I need some money, you know, to further it or whatever, but basically we can transmit electricity wirelessly, you know, and basically an unlimited amount of it. And Morgan said, well, how do you regulate it? And of course, Mr. Tesla said, well, you don't. This is free. You know, it just comes from the Earth. Oh, well, scrap it. You know, no way that Mr. Morgan was gonna fund a project that was going to give free energy to people, for God's sake. Right? How do you regulate it? That's the first question. How do you put a price tag on it? You know, that's the business of industrial capitalism. And, you know, we're on the tail end of that these days, but, you know, it's holding on with tooth and nail. So, at any rate, Nikola Tesla, the amazing Nikola Tesla, died on the 7th of January, 1943, and I just wanted to, you know, make note of he and John Lilly, because they were two really important people. And if you don't know about their work, you should check them out, all right? Okay, one other thing here. Let's see, John Major Jenkins. If you remember, two or three weeks ago, when Jay Widener was on the program, we had Rick Levine, who's going to be joining us just in a few minutes here, but we had Rick on for a little while toward the beginning of the program, and we had John Jenkins on with Jay a little bit later in the show. And if you remember, John mentioned that he was going to be going down to Mexico and going to be visiting some of the sites that he's interested in with regard to his work down there in Izapa, among other places. So, anyway, the news is in. Check this out. And I'm going to read it word for word from an email that John sent me on the 28th of December. All right, check this out. Mike, here I am in the Chiapas town of Tapachula, close to the Guatemala border. Arrived late last night. Early this morning, I got to Izapa before sunrise, and into the site, I saw the solstice sun rising in perfect alignment with the ball court. The entire alignment thesis is visually confirmed. Tomorrow I bring my astronomical instrument to the site at noon for a measurement and secondary confirmation. Filming here with Mystic Fire Video, Izapa is indeed the origin place of the 2012 prophecy, cosmology, and spiritual teaching. Spread the word, John Jenkins. All right, so that came from John just a few days ago. I get a chill just reading it. And by the way, if you want to check this out on the web, go to www.alignment2012.com. That's John Major Jenkins' website. And there's a link there for this little device that John invented and built, a way to measure the azimuth and the rising solstice sun. Anyway, it's a pretty cool little deal that he did, and go over there to his website and check it out. You can always get over to John's site from my site as well. Just go over to MikeHagan.com and page down a little ways, and there's a link over to John's site. And, of course, the interviews that we've done over the last year and a half or two with John Major Jenkins are well worth downloading and listening to. Tremendous, tremendous, outrageous information that John has been bringing for a long time. 1997, of course, his book, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, came out and, you know, stunned both the metaphysical and the scientific communities. And, you know, he has not let up. And this work that he's done over the last couple weeks down there in Izapa is really profound and important. And it means a lot to the people who are interested in this whole 2012 business. And I think it's something maybe we can have Rick comment on as well when we get him on the air here at the top of the hour. But we'll do that in just a few minutes here. Let's see. What else is happening? Well, 5 minutes or so before the top of the hour, let's play a piece of music here, and then we'll come back with Rick Levine and do it up for the next couple hours with him. I'll say hello to a couple of friends of mine that just walked in here to the studio and give me a minute to say hi to them. They brought me a New Year's beer, so I may have to have a little toast. So we'll do that and come back in just a minute and enjoy this one, okay? This one is another piece of music called Longing for the Stars, Soul Valor, on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
That's right, it is Mike, and you're listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, and this is Radio Orbit. Just about straight up midnight now, and we'll say hello to our guest. His name is Rick Levine. He's been on the program a couple of times before, and he's all over the place. If you check on the web with regard to astrological ideas and this sort of thing, he's a great friend of the program, and someone who I'm glad that we connected with last year. So without further delay, we'll say hello again to Rick Levine. And I should mention again Rick's website before we get going too quickly here at www.tarot.com. That's the main one. And another website that you can find information about Rick at is www.stariq.com. So anyway, without further delay, hello, Rick Levine. How are you?
Hey, Mike, Happy New Year. Glad to be here.
Happy New Year. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, well, it's when I committed to do this show several months ago, I had no idea that I would be doing it this late at night from the East Coast rather than my normal comfortable 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the evening from the West Coast.
Right. It's a nice, comfortable interview on the West Coast. It gets a little bit late, though, on the East.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Rick, I'm going to ask you to snuggle up nice and close to that phone. Don't have the best signal with you right now. If I can get a little bit more volume out of you, it'd be great.
Okay. Is that better?
Yeah, much better. Great.
Okay.
All right, look, for the people who aren't familiar with Rick Levine, a little bit about you. You can mention the websites and stuff about the business that you're in. And then let's talk about about last year, 2006, and then this year, what we see happening, okay?
Yes. And let's also talk about the next few years.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you and most of your listening audience know, it continues to get more interesting as time goes on.
Boy, isn't that the truth.
Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking a little earlier, before I came on, about John Lilly and Nikola Tesla.
Right.
And either now or later we can come back and cover a little bit of that ground, but I happen to be a great Tesla fan and maybe even scholar. And I think what you said is very important. My father actually was one of the earlier developers of FM, commercial FM radio.
Is that right?
And so I grew up with coils all around in my house and vacuum tubes and whatever. And most people just don't realize what a not only great genius Nikola Tesla was, but that he kind of was the man who invented the 20th century, and in the early part of the 20th century was considered to be what we would call today a rock star. I mean, he had his picture on the front cover of Time magazine more than anyone in the first part of the 20th century. He played live what we would might call concerts, but he didn't do music. He put on these incredible shows of electrical, you know, displays and his gadgets and his lightning and whatever, and we just don't have any sense of what a force this man was.
Yeah, he was something else, and that's so cool that you're so familiar with his work. How your father was involved in FM radio development?
Well, yeah, during World War II, actually, he was involved in developing some stuff that turned into commercial FM radio, and so I just grew up around, you know, amateur radios and coils and vacuum tubes and wires dangling from everywhere, and Nikola Tesla was not a stranger, even in my childhood, but it really wasn't until later on that I read so much about what was suppressed from his work and his work in Colorado Springs, his, you know, the ability that he had of transmitting power, of lighting electrical lights at a distance of several miles by transmitting power, and, you know, and all these other things.
Yeah, amazing.
Although I don't think Tesla was completely benign. I think he's turned a bit into a folk hero. I mean, Tesla had some pretty strange examples of accidentally creating earthquakes. And you know, there is some belief that the crater in northern Russia that has been attributed to an asteroid actually was a result of a Tesla experiment and shaking the Earth that went a little bit awry.
Right, the Tunguska deal.
Yes.
Right, I've read that argument that some people say it was a scalar directed energy weaponry or some sort of a test that Tesla had undergone.
Right. Now, I'm not saying it was or it wasn't. I'm just saying that there's a lot of strange stuff there. I mean, there are examples of rumblings in New York City that were resonant frequencies that he was playing with that created the destruction of at least his own laboratory on one occasion.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he had a tremendous knowledge of the dynamics of the Earth or something. You know, it was really weird. He had this feeling for the Earth itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, since we are talking a little bit about astrology, one of the things, Nikola Tesla was born July 10th, 1856.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually know the time of his birth, and he was born with the planet Pluto. Oh, I know the astronomers have declassified Pluto, but it doesn't bother us astrologers. Pluto is the planet of death and regeneration. It's the planet of the deepest mysteries. And when Tesla was born, Pluto was exactly on the eastern horizon, just coming up over the horizon. And there's a lot more that we could say about his chart, including the fact that he was born with the moon aligned with Mars. Mars is the planet of power, of energy, of directed current, if you will.
Mm.
And, of course, it's well known that Tesla, you know, was the champion of using a technique that phased electrical current into positive-negative in order to give it the most push. His adversary at the time was Thomas Edison, who was a great proponent of pushing current directly through the wire, and Tesla came up with this idea of phasing it on, off, or plus, minus, and he could actually develop a much higher potential or push of the current. In fact, when Tesla was awarded the Nobel Prize for his work in electricity, he was awarded it to share with Thomas Edison, and Tesla turned the Nobel Prize down, saying that he refused to share such a prestigious award with a mere tinkerer like Thomas Edison.
I love it. I know. Well, they call it revisionist history, you know?
Yeah. Anyhow, so I just wanted to continue the theme and touch a bit on Tesla. We can get back to your original question about, okay, so what's going on up there and what's going on down here and what is astrology and why does it work and all kinds of things like that.
Yeah, I'll mention real fast that for the listeners out there who aren't familiar with you, I came across Rick originally through Jay, our friend Jay Widener. Rick did an amazing video production with Jay's group at Mystic or Sacred.
Sacred Mysteries.
Sacred Mysteries video.
SacredMysteries.com.
Right, and it's called Quantum Astrology, and Jay sent me a copy of it last year, and I was blown away by it, and I loved it, and got a hold of Rick right away and had him on the program. But Rick, let's talk a little bit about astrology and maybe put some myths to rest with regard to what it really is before we get further into it, okay?
Sure. Would you like me just to jump in, or shall
yeah.
I wait for the question?
No, please just jump in.
Well, you know, I think one of the biggest myths about astrology is that it tells the future. And in some ways, it does. But it's just one of many techniques that we have to understand time. Astrology may be a particularly good one. But even still, I'm a firm believer that the universe and the future remain a bit plastic. And I don't mean artificial. I mean malleable. And I think that this is also a very important consideration to keep in mind as we head toward this, you know, looming 2012 date. And that is that what we do today and what we do tomorrow and what we do the next day does have direct impact on what happens the following day. And astrology is really a mapping system of time. In other words, just as if you were going to get in your car and drive to Flagstaff, Arizona, you know, from Columbia, Missouri, you would head out in a general direction. but you wouldn't know exactly what roads to take unless you had a map. And the map would not tell you that you're going to Flagstaff. The map would merely tell you the lay of the land, the distances between the major intersections, and it would give you a good idea of planning the best way for you to get to where you were going.
Right, right.
And by the same token, astrology offers us a system, a mechanistic system, to make maps in time rather than in space. And we can come back to that in a few moments to talk about what, you know, what that really means, because I think it's important to understand that in the post-Einsteinian view of the universe, that time and space are not separate.
You mean in a quantum view?
Well, quantum, yes, but really it was Albert Einstein prior to quantum theory. It was Albert Einstein's general field theory,
mm-hmm,
that showed clearly that there was a direct relationship between time and space.
But let me...
The faster you move, the more time slowed down. Matter of fact, Einstein demonstrated or theorized, I think is more correct, that time was actually gravitationally warped space.
Hmm.
Different than the Newtonian view, where space existed separate from time, and that time was in effect an independent, you know, clock that was not affected by space, that time and space were two separate continuums.
How do the scientists reconcile that, though? Because science has this whole idea that time is independent with regard to experimentation. In other words, it doesn't matter.
This is perhaps, I think, the biggest problem that science faces as it grapples with astrology. It's I think, the reason why astrology has to be rejected,
mm-hmm,
out of hand, regardless of what the experimental data shows, that there is no room for astrology in science, because according to the modern scientific tradition, and I say this based upon the works of David Hume, because modern science requires things to be repeatable.
Mm-hmm.
And that if an experiment is not repeatable, and you hit it exactly, you know, you hit the nail exactly on the head, and that is that time becomes, in the scientific method, an independent variable. If I drop two balls from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, the rate at which they accelerate and hit the ground does not matter whether it's Tuesday or Friday or 6 in the morning or winter or spring, or the time does not matter.
Right.
The mechanics of moving objects are always the same.
Right. So
what happens, though, is that unfortunately this may work in the gross base Newtonian mechanical world of large three-dimensional objects, but it may not work in all realms. And the best example of this is the work of a 20th century chemist who actually worked with Rudolf Steiner.
Oh, I love Steiner, too.
A woman named Lily Kalisko. And she did work that, and you can Google her, and her work is very available on the net. But what she did was an amazing series of experiments that go back to a Steiner concept that actually is an ancient astrological, it's an ancient concept, it's wider than astrology. And this concept relates each of what the ancients called seven primary metals to each of the seven visible planets. So that, and of course in this modality, the sun and the moon are considered planets. So gold becomes the metal related to the sun, silver to the moon, mercury to Mercury, copper to Venus, copper to Venus, iron to Mars, tin to Jupiter, and lead to Saturn. Well, each of those metals can be made into salts, like copper sulfate,
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm,
gold chloride, etc.
Yeah.
And these salts can be dissolved in water, and what Lily Kalisko did was she created supersaturated solutions of these metal salts and then absorbed them into filter paper and then watched the filter paper dry. And what's left is crystalline structures, lattices, that clearly identify each of the substances so that copper sulfate dries in this beautiful, brilliant, blue-green structures that look like copper sulfate crystals. And gold chloride and each of the different salts has different formations.
Right.
But what Marie or what Lily Kalisco showed was that every month for a period of about 4 to 5 hours, that when the moon lined up with the planet related to that particular metal, the metal would not crystallize. In other words, it just stayed gray sludge.
Right.
And this in itself, this experiment, clearly shows that there is a time element involved in what we call the repeatability of experiments.
Right.
These experiments were done again by a man named Nick Kallerstrom at Cambridge University in the 90s, in the 1990s, as part of his PhD thesis in the history of science. And it's just a fascinating aside. And I know we got a little bit off track here, but the point is that the downfall of the experimental tradition is that time is not an independent variable. And it's my sense, Mike, that science, as it exists up through the end of the 20th century, is a bit like a neurosis.
Mm-hmm.
Because a neurosis is a disease based upon an untruth, where we repeat something again and again, expecting a different outcome. And yet our neurotic behavior traps us into this loop, and yet we always get the same outcome. And it seems like with the scientific method, you have to repeat it again and again. It's like washing your hands, 100 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep doing it again and again and again, and if it doesn't come out the same, then it can't possibly have been true.
Right, you throw it out.
Whereas astrology and many of the modern occult sciences, if you will, clearly show that very important things happen only once.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, Rick, because, there is a crisis in science, and I think that, scientific people who are paying attention recognize that there's a crisis in science, and I'd almost suggest, a new definition of science. Maybe something like, science is the study of phenomena which are so fundamental or basic that they are time independent.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a hydrogen atom will cleave from oxygen the same way every time, but relationships don't work like that.
How true.
So it seems like maybe, science should not have any business talking about dynamic things that that are obviously affected by the temporal relationships of the world.
Yeah, the only problem with that is the subatomic particle realm.
Hmm.
And that is that it appears that there is an interference from the realm of thought into the realm of matter. That can be documented. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of, I think it's Robert Jahn at Princeton University, PAIR, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Center.
Yeah, they run that random number generator, right?
Well, they've done many things over the years, but what their area of study has been in the interface or interference of man's mind over or in impacting, non-animate objects like computer chips, like random number generators, et cetera. But the point here is that with the advent of quantum physics throughout the 20th century, physics, the hardest core of all hardcore sciences, basically went soft. It was like the rug was pulled out from underneath the material universe.
Mm-hmm.
Because you say that science should be limited to only things that are things. And it turns out, as Buckminster Fuller said, there are no things
right.
out there.
Right.
There are no things out there. What we perceive is what we perceive as things is simply the result of nodes of interference patterns created by very high frequency electromagnetic radiation creating the appearance of things that are solid, and yet things that are solid are 99.9% empty, vacuous space. So what's left for science to study? Nothing, by that definition. I mean, these are important questions.
Right.
But we've fallen a moment away from the specifics of what is astrology, how does it work, what's this year like, what's next year like,
right. Well,
what's
next
coming up.
Right. Well, I think if nothing else, you know, we've made an argument, though, to show that science is a tool like any other tool, but it is not a meta-theory at whose feet every other area of endeavor must be laid to get the thumbs up or the thumbs down from science.
Oh, absolutely. I love John Anthony West's way of describing science as the church of science. You know, it's the church of progress, the church of science. They have their own, you know, rituals that must be conformed to. They have their own kind of ritualistic costumes of robes and language, etc. And there's this whole basis of belief. You know, it's what Deepak Chopra calls the superstition of materialism. You know, it's a great superstition. And science as we know it, is based upon the superstition that, you know, things are what's important. And then we have a movement in modern science, I wouldn't say led by, but one of the champions is Roger Penrose, who I like to think of as the brains behind Stephen Hawking. Roger Penrose, who was the originator of the topological thing called the Penrose tiles, was a great mathematician. He did a lot of the math and actually coined the word black holes, I believe. But Roger Penrose wrote a wonderful book called The Emperor's New Mind. You know the story about the emperor's new clothes?
Sure.
Well, he wrote a book called The Emperor's New Mind. And he's written several other books also, but they're not simple books, but they delve into this question of, from the outside, how do you tell whether there's deep consciousness or whether it's just surface behavior? In other words, if I meet you, how do I know that you're not just some sort of programmed computer on the phone that's just programmed to interact with me in a very clever way?
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes the basis for trying to understand where does science, how far can science reach? Roger Penrose has coupled up with a group out of University of Arizona under I'm trying to think of the guy's name. He was in What the Bleep. I'll think of his name in a minute.
Okay.
It's eluding me, but he was Stuart Hameroff.
Yeah.
Stuart Hameroff. And this whole branch of thinking is called quantum reductionism, because what's now believed is that consciousness does not originate in the brain. It originates in the vibrations of microtubules in every cell in the body. Microtubules used to be considered the bone structure of a cell, the lattice of a cell.
Uh-huh.
But they actually have a hum, and it's believed that these hums are actually controlled by quantum analysis, quantum mathematics, and that the actual neuron only fires when the hum has already reached a critical point in these microtubules. So, again, we digress, but the point is, science ain't what it used to be.
No doubt about it. All right, Rick, let's move back to what science isn't, all right? And it's certainly not the paying attention to the movement of the stars and the planets and that sort of thing, at least not with the idea that those things affect day-to-day life and the experiences of people.
Exactly, because science would have us believe that man and nature are separate and that man can actually observe nature as a detached entity, but that man and nature are two separate entities or separate forces, whereas astrology says that the universe, astrology like quantum physics, says that the universe actually has its own innate intelligence and that all things are connected. Non-locality theory says that everything is connected to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell a scientist that half the population of Earth bleeds on a monthly basis in a very close proximity to a lunation or lunar cycle, the new moon, full moon cycle, you know, a 28-day cycle, and the scientist would say, yes, but the menstrual cycle's, you know, similarity to the lunar cycle is just coincidence.
Yeah.
As if coincidence meant that it was unimportant, but then we have the movement of the whole Eastern Asian philosophies, Carl Jung's concept of synchronicity, and that is that coincidences are not unimportant. They are, in fact, a different way of looking at the time-space relationship.
Right. There was this this great science philosopher. His name was P.W. Bridgman, and he used to say that a coincidence is the result of the application of a flawed theory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you missed something.
Yeah. Whereas the truth is that a coincidence are simply two incidences that are somehow related.
Right. Right.
And so, as an astrologer, I look at the movement of the cycles of the sun, or the earth around the sun, the moon around the earth, and all of the planets in their apparent paths around the sky, around the sun or the earth. It's just a mapping system, and we astrologers use a geocentric mapping system, but we understand that Einstein's concept of relativity says that everything in the universe moves. You got to pick a point, make it stable, and map things from there.
Right. In other words, you're looking at the most effective. In other words, you're not that concerned about the solar system moving around its particular center.
Well, some astrologers, quite frankly, modern astrologers are. But traditional or classical astrology is basically looking at the sun and the moon and the planets as they move against the backdrop of what appears to be a rather fixed heaven.
Okay, all right.
And as it turns out, the movement of these planets against the fixed backdrop of stars turns out to be an amazingly accurate metaphor for not only understanding human dynamics, human personality, human relationships, but maybe more germane to the conversation that we are having today, it turns out to be very relevant to understanding the nature of time throughout history, the changes of culture in history, the wars, the rise and falls of civilizations, etc. And this then becomes another whole area of astrology that we astrologers call mundane, mundane from the Latin word mundus, or world, and this is world astrology.
So, again, it sort of goes back to the idea that that the time isn't really linear either. It's not a steady progression from a state of, for example,
from a beginning to a middle to an end.
Right. Right. That's a great way to put it. So it's not
in
like
fact
that
the Hindus, for example, again, we go to some of the Asian traditions. The Hindus, in particular, understood that time was cyclical. That everything went round and round and round and round and round again on these, you know, great wheels of time.
Right, and you had all the yugas and all that sort of thing.
Exactly. And basically what we astrologers understand is that time is an illusion that's created by something moving around something else. You get a repetitive pattern, you begin to understand the nature of time.
Hmm.
But without and yet we in the West study history. How? By making a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we lose the concept of cyclicity in time that the Mayans incidentally had, but we lose that concept of historical cycles. So we see something like the World Trade Tower, you know, the World Trade Tower bombing, you know, of September 11, 2001.
Right.
We see that as an isolated incident rather than seeing it as part of an ongoing Saturn-Pluto cycle that we can trace clear back to the fall of Rome. We can tie in events such as, you know, Muhammad's taking of Mecca and establishing the State of Islam, including the Moorish invasion of Spain, the Battle of Hastings, World War I. I mean, I'm just picking out a handful of things,
right.
But this repetitive cycle seems to involve the clashes of civilizations as their points of view, their reality structures, brush up against each other and create brush fires, and that then test to see which theory or which idea or which point of view will be dominant. And with the clash between the Muslim and Christian point of view, you see this, you know, over and over and over again, including, you know, several of the Crusades and the whole rise of Israel, the important dates of what's happened, these are all tied to this very same cycle. And once you begin to see the cycle, then it becomes a very, very different way of looking at history. And I might recommend that if you haven't had on the show, that you get Rick Tarnas, that's Dr. Richard Tarnas, who works with Stan Groff at the California Integral at the California Institute of Integral Studies.
Right, I love Stan Groff.
And well, Rick Tarnas and Stan Groff co-chair or co-direct their PhD program in consciousness studies. And Rick Tarnas wrote a book called Passion of the Western Mind, which is considered to be probably the best intellectual history of the West. It's used in colleges all across the country. And his new book, which came out just barely a year ago, called Cosmos and Psyche. Psyche and Cosmos.
I've seen that. I've seen it on the shelf, actually.
Yeah, it is a totally mind-boggling, impressive study of history relating it to these astrological cycles. And it makes a case that is absolutely overwhelming. I mean, this is a guy who's probably one of the greatest living historians and has already been acknowledged for that. And he turns around and writes this book that creates this incredible case for how history and our changes in consciousness are correspondent to the cycles of these outer planets that repeat in their paths over and over again. You know, just like we have a new moon once a month.
And a full moon tonight.
And a full moon. Actually, the full moon is on the 3rd. It's tomorrow night.
Is it? Okay. It looked full enough to me, so.
Yeah, it feels full. It feels, well, and around the full moon or new moon, it's really about 2 or 3 days where we feel the energy. But anyhow, the full moon once a month, or actually once a moon, because our month is really based upon a moon.
Right.
And so the full moon is a cycle where these two planets, or these two, planetary cycles, and again, from an astrological point of view, we include the sun and moon as the word planet, because to the Greeks, anything that moved up there was a planet.
Right.
Anyhow, this cycle repeats 12, 13 times a year, where the sun and the moon line up once on one side of the earth, and then a fortnight later, or a half of a month later, 2 weeks later, they line up on opposite sides of the earth.
Right.
Well, that cycle is a very fast cycle. But if you take a look, for example, at the cycles of, let's say, Uranus and Neptune, align up only once every 171 years. And then halfway through that, about 80,
85, 86 years.
Something like that, yeah. 86, then they line up opposite each other. But this cycle in itself is a fascinating cycle to map against our historical development, because you begin to see the continuity of things that you otherwise wouldn't notice. You can do it with any planetary pair, even Neptune and Pluto, which only line up once every 500 years. And these longer-term, low-frequency, repetitive cycles become really the backbone, the fabric for the rise and fall of civilization.
So there are historical punctuation marks at these particular times.
Exactly, well said.
All right.
Incidentally, in the 20th century, the greatest punctuation mark, well, actually, there were two of them. Well, there were a few of them, but the greatest one was probably in the mid-1960s. And then again in the early 1990s. And even though we had some serious wars in there, which also had their own punctuation marks, I might add, that it was the mid-60s when everything changed. You know, whether you were living in Europe or even the Cultural Revolution in China, something happened in the Earth was a different place before the 60s and after the 60s.
Very interesting. Certainly was that way in the United States. We know the 60s were an amazing time here.
And during that period of time, Uranus and Neptune made their once every 171-year alignment.
Huh.
Except this particular one had the planet Saturn in the picture also, which only happens once every four times that alignment occurs. And you begin to see here, you know, these patterns. And again, there was another very rare alignment in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when, you know, the Berlin Wall fell, when we had the Exxon Valdez, and we began to realize that recycling wasn't just for a bunch of hippies or ex-hippies. We had the, you know, entire Iron Curtain fall, and, you know, those were the years that kept map makers in business.
Right, no doubt. All right, Rick, let's take a break, okay?
You got it.
Great stuff, everybody. It's Rick Levine. We've got him on the line with us live. Where are you at, Rick? You're in Atlanta?
I'm in Atlanta visiting. Yeah.
All right, Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks for sticking around with us, Rick. It's late in the night there. We'll come back with him in just a few minutes, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's about 12:35 now on the 2nd of January, 2007. We'll play a piece of music here from our friend Dennis Thielman. This is Soul Valor, and the song is called Orient to Orion. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Rick Levine. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. And also, Rick on the web can be found at www.tarot.com and also at stariq.com. All right, that's Rick Levine. Back with him in just a few minutes. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. Thank you. Soul Valor. That's Orient to Orion. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Rick Levine. He's an amazing astrologer. You can find information about him on the web at www.tarot.com and also at www.stariq.com. And, Rick, I'm not sure if it's time to bring up the Tarot or not, but because it's the name of your website, I think we should at least acknowledge it. The Tarot is another way of looking at these resonant cycles of time.
Tarot is less time-oriented than it is image-based. Just for the matter of record, Tarot.com is not my website, but Tarot.com distributes my writing all over the web. It's a great site. They specialize in all forms of divination, including tarot, numerology, I Ching, and astrology. And I'm involved only with the astrology part of Tarot.com, but it's all really good stuff. They're very, very highly reputable. In fact, I write a daily horoscope column that Tarot.com distributes. It is the daily horoscope column on AOL, on MySpace, on Google, on Netscape, and probably 30 or 40 other, you know, lesser sites. And so Tarot.com is my main connection to the web. They're great people, and I encourage people to go to that site and support them. And, of course, they can find out more about me if they go to the astrology section there.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say that I did a Google on you over the last few hours or so, and your name's everywhere out there.
Yeah, well, so is Britney Spears. It doesn't mean that much. No.
Well, you're certainly making an impact. I'll tell you that much.
But you know, and I suppose aside from the DVD, which you did mention, that Jay Widener's company produced, is available at either sacredmysteries.com. It's also available at amazon.com. That talks a lot about these historical cycles that we've been talking about a little bit and some other things, and that's called Quantum Astrology. And I also should mention that my new book is at the front checkout counters of Barnes and Noble's across the country. It's called Your Astrology Guide 2007. It's an annual book that I write with my writing partner, Jeff Jauer.
Right.
And it's what we call sun sign. It's based upon the time of year you were born, the I'm a Taurus, you're a Gemini thing. But it's still a very helpful book for better understanding the map of your year ahead, Your Astrology Guide 2007, and that's also available on Amazon.com by Sterling Press, Barnes & Noble.
All right.
So I'm done with the commercial.
No, okay, good. I mean, people want to know this stuff because, I had three or four phone calls when I went to break there, people asking about where can they find information about you, who's Rick Tarnas, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, obviously people interested. Let's see. All right, resonant time, repetitive cycles. You mentioned that you do this thing every year with your book. Let's talk about 2007. And then about these repetitive cycles, I mean, should we be looking backwards to see what might be forward?
Well, yes. I think that that's always a good thing to do. However, when we do that, we run into the danger of what Marshall McLuhan called rear-view mirrorism. And that's driving the car forward by looking in the rear-view mirror. It doesn't always work.
Mm-hmm.
But we can learn a lot by looking backward. You know, the thing is that these slower-moving planets move into angles with each other. An astrological word that is often misunderstood is the word aspect. Two planets make aspects. And aspects are really about geometry. I don't want to delve too far into this. This could be another show sometime if you'd like. But when two planets make an angle with each other, whether they're like at a full moon, the angle is 180 degrees because they're opposite,
mm-hmm.
or at a new moon, the angle is 0 degrees,
right,
they're lined up.
Mm-hmm.
At a half moon, first quarter or third quarter moon, the angle is 90 degrees. other angles aren't so obvious, but whenever two planets make a particular angle, they make an aspect. And those aspects, based upon the angle, each have different meanings tied to the nature of the aspect. And this goes back to the ancients, certainly Plato in the Platonic solids and the angles formed by these solids, you know, was part of his philosophical understanding. But when we look at these outer planets, we look at some of these aspects, and we see that, that some years there are many, and some years there's not much going on, even though there still may be things going on historically. And as it turns out, the latter part of 2006, on through most of 2007, the predominant aspect is an opposition that's like a full moon, where Earth is coming between the two planets, and the two planets involved in this opposition are the planets Saturn and Neptune.
Okay.
Saturn is the gatekeeper. To the ancients, Saturn was the outward planet. Beyond Saturn, there was nothing but the, you know, the fixed stars. It was the slowest moving rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Saturn, etymologically, is Satan. Same word. And Saturn was the you get what you deserve. Saturn's the is Father Time. Saturn is the Grim Reaper.
Right.
Saturn
Kronos.
Is karma. It's what you get is what you deserve. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, Kronos. I was just thinking about time. And...
That's right. That's right. As a matter of fact, Saturn is just Latin for Kronos, which is Greek.
Right.
Exactly. And so Saturn was the ultimate keeper of time. Saturn is about a 30-year cycle. In fact, in our culture, the Saturn cycle is so important that we refer to people as either over 30 or under 30.
Huh,
something
yes.
happens when Saturn returns to where it was when we were born, and we grow up. It's real adulthood. Real adulthood isn't 21. Real adulthood is the Saturn return at 29, 30. We go through stuff and we take on responsibility.
Huh.
So
I'm trying to think back 12 years. And when I turned 30, yeah, certainly that was a tumultuous time, I can tell you that.
Yeah, 29
much.
Is usually astrologically when it hits.
Hmm.
And usually after that, we live in a different world. We've taken on new responsibilities, or if we haven't, then often our mid-30s are very difficult when that Saturn gets to the opening square, the 90-degree angle, and we have this mid-30s depression because our life is unrecoverable. We can't make it go the direction we wanted it to had we taken the right move at around age 29, 30.
Very interesting.
So we have this Saturn cycle of 30 years. Saturn spends about 2.5 years, therefore, in each of 12 signs to go around once in 30 years. Simple mathematics.
Right.
So Saturn, in the summer of 2005, moved into the sign of Leo, which means that through the latter part of 2005 and all of 2006 and most of 2007, people who are sun sign Leos are getting their turn at having reality, Saturn, being pushed upon them, and they get what they deserve. Now, this is a gross generalization.
What is, now I say this from a personal standpoint, I'm August 15th. Am I a sun sign Leo?
Yeah, because Leo begins around July 20th
uh-huh.
and ends around August 20th.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a July 15th, you were born with the sun at about 25 degrees. Into the 30-degree sector of Leo.
Uh-huh.
Each sign is 30 degrees.
Right, right.
I don't want to go too deep into the mathematics, but the point is that Saturn doesn't reach the degree where your sun is, Mike, until next spring
mm-hmm.
and on into the summer. So chances are you have some pretty big changes coming up that are very real that you probably already know what they are because Saturn is never about surprises.
Yeah, man, I know what they are.
It's always about the real thing that, you know, it's the elephant on the table.
Right.
The thing that you know that's there, but you can't get there faster than you can get there. And so I would suggest that by next June, July, August, that by September you'll be clear. You'll be on the other side of this, because by September Saturn moves on into the next sign, and Virgos will begin to get their taste of the reality check that you're dealing with now.
Now it doesn't have to be a negative connotation either, right?
Oh, no. It's crystallization. Saturn makes things real. It makes things last. It's the sustainer. And it's the things that are not real go away. The things that are real, you know, again, it's you get what you deserve.
And
usually it's a mixture of things. So the thing is that Saturn has been for the last year and will be through until September of 2007. Saturn is in the sign of Leo. It spends about 2 years, 2.5 years in each sign. Now, just hold that for a second and let's jump to the planet Neptune, which takes 165 years to go around once. So Neptune spends about 14 years in each sign. Much slower moving. Neptune is the god of the ocean. Neptune is nebulous. Neptune, if Saturn crystallizes things and makes things real, Neptune dissolves the hard edges of reality, because everything washes back into the sea, and there are no boundaries in the sea. But Neptune is also about the seas of consciousness, and so Neptune is imagination, it's dreams. Neptune, as anything that dissolves the hard edges of reality, in a lab, alcohol is considered the universal solvent because it dissolves crystals. And interestingly enough, when we drink alcohol, it also, as a Neptunian substance, dissolves the hard edges of reality.
Isn't that the truth?
And it's interesting that there are two basic Neptunian substances, alcohol and oil. Why oil? Well, oil basically dissolves the hard edges of reality. You know, you put it in an engine where there are these pistons are grinding metal on metal, and all of a sudden it says, no hard edges here. And so it's very, very interesting that when the planet Neptune aligned with the planet Saturn back in 1989, within 12 hours of this alignment, the Exxon Valdez, a tanker carrying a Neptunian substance oil, driven by a guy who had been drinking too much Neptunian substance alcohol,
oh my gosh,
hit a Saturnian substance, reality, the rocks.
Right. Amazing.
So you can't make this stuff up this good.
Amazing.
You can't make it up this good.
And 89 was the Berlin Wall as well, and the fall of the Soviet Union, the whole
thing. Yeah, actually, the Exxon Valdez was 88. In 89, Saturn moved on and bumped into the next planet, because 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93 was a very rare alignment of Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And so by 89, during the Berlin Wall, also within 6 hours of the stone being taken off the top of the wall and the whole thing disintegrating, Saturn, the planet of structure, of walls, of reality, met the planet Uranus, which is the planet of instantaneous change.
Very interesting.
And again, I mean, these things are timed so closely that you can't even, you know, these cycles happen so rarely. They're once every century or century and a half. Anyhow, the Saturn-Neptune cycle is a little more regular, because that's about a 35-year cycle, which means that the half cycle, is roughly 16, 17 years, something like that. But the last time that Saturn and Neptune lined up was in 1989, and that was at their full. That was at their new moon phase. They were lined up on the same side of the Earth.
Right.
The last time they were lined up opposite on either side of Earth was in the early 70s, 1971, 72. That's what they're doing again now in 2006, 2007. And there are some very interesting similarities between the 71-72 period and the 2006-2007 period.
Wow. Vietnam, Iraq, that's one that comes to mind.
That was Vietnam and Iraq. I mean, and incidentally, this was the same cycle that was at the very end of World War One. And what happens when, you see, the planet Saturn is about the hard, cold facts of reality, and the planet Neptune is about the illusions. It's about the dreams. And often when Saturn and Neptune reach their full moon phase, like they did in 71, like they did in 2006-2007, what happens is that there's a great disillusionment that sweeps the nation. Because the illusions turn into reality. You know, we had Watergate back in, you know, this in 71-72.
Right.
And, you know, and the resignation of Nixon. And I, you know, from an astrological point of view, whether that similar energy goes down or not, it certainly appears that we have a president like Nixon who is becoming, you know, regardless of your political leanings, becoming embarrassingly more transparent as he tries to, you know, cover his butt.
Right. All right, look.
So that's a big one. You know, this Uranus-Neptune, Uranus-Saturn opposition is a big one, and it affects all of us individually because we all have to contend with those things in our life that we thought were real, that somehow now we're having to deal with the reality of what's behind the illusion when the dreams, when the clouds of illusion actually precipitate down to Earth. It's never as pretty as it was when it was up there in imagination.
The truth. Hey, Rick, we got to take a break in a couple minutes, but let me sneak one more in here before then, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple people who are asking questions about these borderlines between signs. In other words, a girl who's listening says September 23rd. Some say Virgo, some say Libra.
Very easy, very quick and easy answer.
Yeah.
Our calendar is totally screwed.
Yes. Okay.
The calendar is a solar calendar, and yet it's sloppy, so that every year the beginning of the astrological year happens on the vernal equinox, on the first day of spring.
Right, in March.
And it's either March 19th, 20th, or 21st.
Right.
And so the Latin word for edge is cusp.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone is born on the cusp, it just means that they're born on the edge between two signs. It's very easy to find out whether you're a Virgo or a Libra or whatever your signs are, because even though it changes every year, nowadays you can go to the web. You can go to tarot.com, in fact, and go to the astrology section, put in your birth date, time, and place, and free of charge, although there are other things that they can sell you, but free of charge, they'll tell you the degree of your sun and moon and all of the planets at the time that you were born, and then once and for all, you can know whether you're a Virgo or a Libra.
Okay.
And the lines up there are pretty clear. In other words, the difference of birth of a few minutes can make the difference between being a Virgo or a Libra, or between being a Scorpio or a Sagittarius or any two bordering signs.
All right, cool. Let's take another breather, okay?
Sure.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Rick Levine. Find information about Rick in the astrology section at tarot.com, T-A-R-O-T, and also at a website, www.star-iq.com, and you'll be able to link over to Rick's sites from my site as well. And we'll be back to Rick in just a couple of minutes, okay? All right, it's just about 1 o'clock in the morning now on the 2nd of the 2nd of January now, 2007. We'll play another song here from Soul Valor. This one is called Iapetus. And, of course, Iapetus is a moon of Saturn. We've been talking about Saturn, so here's one we'll play from Dennis Thielman, Soul Valor on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Rick Levine. All right, that's Iapetus from Soul Valor. One more time, great music from Dennis Thielman. Thanks for that. We'll have a couple more from Dennis as we finish out the program tonight. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. I got a couple people in the studio with me here. If you hear people yelling in the background, that's good news. It's New Year's, and love having the visitors. So, anyway, we've got Rick Levine on the line with us from a remote location in Atlanta, Georgia. Not on the West Coast like he normally is, but he's good enough to spend the time with us again tonight. So, Rick, thanks for sticking around, man.
Oh, yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Let's call this at an undisclosed remote location in Atlanta.
All right. What? How have your holidays been? I'm not sure how you celebrate them, but you had a good time the last couple weeks?
I celebrate any holiday at any time for any reason. If there's a holiday, I'm in. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, that's a simple one for me. I've had a great holiday season, although a lot of it has been rather quiet. Jeff Jauer and I are intensely in the mode of writing against deadlines for our 2008 book. You know, plus we're doing the promos for the 2007, and, you know, plus I write 1,000 words a day for my daily column, and plus I see clients, so I've been kind of busy. But I have had some, you know, some good downtime and some quiet time with, you know, dear friends and family.
All right, good. I'm glad. I have such great hopes for this year and for, you know, for the coming few years, and I'm glad to hear that things are starting off well for most of the people that I've been talking to. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So speaking of that, let's move forward. What else we have happening in 2007 up there? You know, a lot of people are talking about Pluto. Is it worth speaking about Pluto at all?
Oh, sure. I think Pluto is always worth speaking about. Here's the deal. Pluto is Latin for Hades, which is Greek for hell. Okay?
Okay.
So that's where we start this discussion. We're talking about hell. Now, before we go any further, I have to say a quick word about a guy who I'm a great fan of, who maybe some of your listeners know about, maybe you know about, a guy named Charles Fort.
Sure, Charlie Fort. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Charles Fort wrote a few books back in the early 1900s. And one of them was a book called The Book of the Damned.
There you go, The Book of the Damned. You know, I've got to jump in. I made a joke a few weeks ago on the show. There was an article that came out in some science website about 21 books to get you through the through and to the 21st century, right?
Yeah.
And I couldn't even begin the list, so I listed my 21 books that I thought people should read, right?
Oh, what a good idea.
And Charles Fort, The Book of the Damned, should have been on my 21, but I neglected to include it. But, man, that's one I'm going to write on the website for sure.
Well, as you know, then, I mean, what Charles Fort wrote about was things that were things that didn't, those one of the things that we were talking about before, the one of a time occurrences that
right.
don't fit in.
Right.
You know, plagues that were based on frogs raining from the sky and, you know, these strange kind of biblically proportioned events that have, you know, been recorded in history that couldn't have happened, shouldn't have happened, but did.
Right, and just get removed from the record, basically.
Okay, so I don't know if you remember, but for me, this is indelibly planted, imprinted on my brain. And that's the opening sentence of The Book of the Damned. And Charles Fort wrote, by the way, the New York Times reviewed this book and said to read Charles Fort is to ride a comet. All right, so the opening book, the opening line of The Book of the Damned, I think this was about 1923, if I'm not mistaken. I may be wrong, but I think it's pretty close. The opening line of the book was this, quote, "By the damned, I mean the excluded," end quote. Now, this is incredibly important for what's going on with Pluto's exclusion as a planet. You see, because Pluto was only discovered in the 30s, interestingly, all planets that have been discovered, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, were each discovered at a time in history when something was going on that was similar to the imagery and the energy of that particular planet. For example, Uranus was discovered in the late 1700s, around the time of both the American and French Revolutionary Wars, a around the time of great individualism, and Uranus is about individuality. It's about the freedom that happens when one says, I am not connected to any chains of anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, coming back to Pluto, having been discovered in the 1930s during the rise of mass fascism and, you know, the time that led up to World War II,
right.
You know, we had the rise of Tito, of Hitler, of Stalin, of Mussolini, you know, and so on. Anyhow, Pluto, as the lord of the underworld, gains power when it is excluded, because the underworld is all that doesn't appear on the surface. James Hillman, the great psychologist, mm-hmm. has written a lot about what he calls the hell realms, which are basically the unconscious, everything that doesn't fit up into the three-dimensional world that we,
right.
you know, that we live in out there.
Uh-huh.
And so if Pluto, the planet Pluto, relates to everything that is powerful, that isn't talked about, that is hidden, whether it's our fear and terror, whether it's sexual urges, whether it's the hatred that we have, whether it's just these things that are unacceptable, the unconscious gains power when we don't see, when we're not aware of it.
Mm.
The way that you cure neurosis, the way that you deal with the hell realms, is you shine light, awareness on it, and that which was frightening then becomes okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that the planet that represents the excluded, the hell realms, has been damned and been excluded from this little cozy planetary neighborhood by the scientists who can't integrate this into their way of thinking, I think is absolutely symbolically perfect. Does it make Pluto less powerful? No. On one hand, Pluto doesn't give a damn. On the other hand, he kind of likes it, because being excluded makes the hell realms more powerful. If they weren't excluded, they would not be powerful. It's they gain their power because they are considered not okay.
All right.
Now, from an astrological point of view, all of this really doesn't matter at all. It doesn't matter whether the sun or the moon is a planet, or, you know, a luminary or a satellite. It doesn't matter what a group of intellectual scientists, you know, might label it. The fact of the matter is that any astrologer who has followed the rhythm of Pluto and seen it in how it operates in charts of their clients knows that, you know, that just by relabeling it, you know, a dwarf planet, you know, certainly isn't going to take any power away from it.
All right. Does Pluto have any significant alignments coming up this year?
Well, not this year, but, you know, Pluto was opposite Saturn around the 2001, you know, September 11, 2001 World Trade Tower we talked about before bombing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Pluto was aligned, aligned with Uranus. Uranus, the planet of instantaneous change. Pluto, you know, the dredging up of the unconscious from the hell realms. That alignment of Pluto and Uranus took place in the mid-60s. It defined the 60s. In 2012, Uranus and Pluto reach its, in effect, like it's like the first quarter moon, they reach their 90-degree angle.
Mm.
And so, regardless of what you believe about the Mayan calendar, or about the transit of Venus, and in the room a couple of people asked about transits of Venus.
Right.
If you want to talk about that for a minute, I'm certainly willing. But the fact is that from 2010 all the way up through 2012, we're going to be getting a replaying of what went down in the 60s because of this square, of this tension between all of the issues that were raised then and all of the things that did not happen as a result of what was raised then, what was kind of stuffed back away.
Could it be considered sort of a coming of age or a fruition of sorts? Or is that not a good metaphor?
Well, I think it's less a coming of age than it is a, I want to say, coming to Jesus. I don't really mean it that way.
Right.
It's like I think the if Pluto is everything that is excluded, damned, if you think of the stuff in our body that's excluded, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say it on the air.
Sure, say it.
Well, Pluto is about shit. It's about all the stuff that's excluded.
Mm.
And so when Pluto squares Uranus, it's the time when some of the shit's going to hit the fan. And an astrological point of view, I don't think it's just about fruition. If we look at this Pluto-Uranus cycle, I mean, it usually stirs up stuff that has to do with fighting against tyranny, and it doesn't always turn out totally well. I mean, in the 60s, there was this incredible flowering of 65 and 66 when Uranus actually aligned with Pluto. Interestingly enough, in the spring of 66, when Uranus was aligned with Pluto, we had Mick Jagger in Madison Square Garden saying, "Please allow me to introduce myself."
Right.
You know, I mean, this is the song of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coming up, it was like these powerful urges were not going to be repressed; they were not going to be stuffed away. I don't think that there are just good and bad labels that we can throw around these things,
mm-hmm.
but I think that we will see another wave of fighting against the dominance and suppression of whatever the power structures are that in some ways flowered, and I think that's a good word because of the whole flower child,
mm-hmm.
that flowered in the 60s. I think from 2010 to 2012, we're going to see waves of this rebellion come up again. And although anyone who is on top might label it terrorism if it's being perpetuated by whomever it is on the bottom, the fact of the matter is that those who are suppressed and repressed are going to explode back onto the scene.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting reference, the mid-60s, because certainly there were things that were revealed then that really couldn't be extinguished. They were tucked away pretty tightly for quite some time, and I'm talking about psychedelics in particular, but there are other things, ideas, philosophies in general. But those things, again, are making an absolute and really interesting resurgence, and people are really taking another look at these things.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
So this really then leads us up to the whole 2012 thing, and from an astrological point of view, and if anyone has seen, you know, Jay's new movie on, on the 2012, the apocalypse, you know, isn't what it used to be.
That's right. Armageddon isn't what it used to be.
Armageddon isn't what it used to be. You know, my cameo appearance in it is pretty straightforward. And what I say as an astrologer is I'm advising my clients not to cancel their appointments for 2013.
That's right. And we should mention this video, Rick, because it is fantastic. And you have a little bit more than a cameo, I'd say. But at any rate, it's called the Odyssey 2012. And it's been produced by Jay Widener and Sharon Rose, Sacred Mysteries video. And you can find information about it at jaywidener.com. And I think it actually has its own website, but I won't hazard a guess as to what it is. But just go.
Yeah, I think it might be 2012 something. Yeah, and you can link to it from the Sacred Mysteries website or jaywidener.com.
Yeah, and it's something else. It's really worth seeing. There are lots of really interesting people that are chiming in on this whole topic. Rick is one of them, and you're even though as you say, you may not have a really gigantic part in it. It's more of a docudrama, documentary, but it's really relevant stuff that you do touch on.
Well, and the thing is that I'm not an expert in the Mayan calendar or in this particular prophecy. I've certainly, you know, been familiar with it both through the works of Jose Arguelles, through John Major Jenkins, through Jay's work. Certainly through the work of Terence McKenna, who arrived at the 2012 date through a totally independent way of getting there based upon some mathematics of the I Ching and something that he called time wave zero, mm-hmm. and understanding time as a function of how unique or novel a particular moment was. But the point is, from an astrological perspective, the planets will still be moving around in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I say, kind of tongue-in-cheek, don't cancel your appointments for 2013, is that regardless of what it is that we're moving into, regardless of what it is that we actually deal with as we're in the midst of it, in this 2010 to 2012 period of time, and regardless of who makes it out the other end alive, and I think that there will be casualties. And I'm not a doomsayer. I'm not a doom and gloom person. But it does not take an astrologer, nor does it take a whole lot of intelligence to see that we can't continue going the way that we've been going.
Right, no question about it.
And from that standpoint, I think that the 2010 through 2012 period of time will be a bit of a gateway, and yet it's more important that we begin to make the changes today rather than just waiting to see what will happen or just thinking that it's going to all end then. Nothing's going to end then. I heard it said, I think it might have been Michael Harner who once said, that planet Earth, it's talked about how this is a dangerous time for planet Earth with all the species being killed off and global changes and warming and so on. And Michael Harner says, this is not a dangerous time for planet Earth. Earth will survive. It's just humans who are in danger.
Right, right. Yeah.
I think sometimes we elevate our own importance by thinking, and I think this is true for every generation, that they believe that they live in the end of time. It gets back to time as, linear, and everyone wants to think that, that their life is so important that they're going to be the ones that are around when it all goes down.
Right, right, right. Yeah, interesting when you were talking, you mentioned briefly Carl Jung before, and I'd love to get his viewpoint on the way that things are working out right now.
Well, I'll tell you his viewpoint. He wrote about it in his last book called Something in the Unconscious. I'll think of this title. It's late at night. My brain's a little fuzzy. But in the last book that he wrote, he basically said that the solution to wars on the planet will not be solved politically, that the salvation of the world will come from the salvation of each soul within the world. And that he felt that the repression, that the intense, psychological traumas and repressed anger and hate and all that kind of stuff was so venomous that it was almost like a hissing she-goat that was spreading this venom out, and that if we didn't deal with it on an individual person-by-person-by-person basis, that this would continue to grow and to take over the world. And I think that to some extent, unfortunately, we have seen some of that.
Yeah, it seems that way. But I wonder if it's sort of like the snake eating its tail, too, to a certain extent.
The Ouroboros?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's this wonderful old story that I think is a Chinese Zen story that Zen master's son goes off hunting, and days and weeks go by, and he doesn't come back, and all the villagers come to him and say, oh, this is terrible, something's awful has happened to your son. And the Zen master says, good news, bad news, who's to know?
Mm-hmm.
And a few days later, his son comes back with two wild horses, and all the villagers come and say, this is great, you're now the wealthiest person in the village, and this is amazing, what good luck. And he says, good news, bad news, who's to know? And a few days later, his son is thrown from one of the horses while he was breaking it in, breaks his leg, it's planting season, and all the villagers come by and say, this is terrible, you're what a great tragedy. And he says, good news, bad news, who's to know? And the next day, the king's army comes through town conscribing all the young eligible males, but they can't take his son because he has a broken leg.
We never know.
And right. Everything that is good turns bad, and everything that's bad turns good. it's one of the great misunderstood pieces of Nietzsche's concept of nihilism, and that is that which is most important and becomes the most good and is at the top of the mountain has to fall off and go to the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. All right, before we take another break here, let's do talk about Venus for a moment.
Okay, well, you know, talking about Venus for a moment is a bit dangerous because, you know, Venus is the goddess incarnate, and she likes to get her just due. And so talking about her just for a moment is like a little bit scary because
Talk about her as long as we need to. How about that?
Well, okay, so here's an interesting thing. You know, the myth of Venus is that Venus was born out of the foam of the sea on the island of Cyprus.
Mm.
Interestingly, I talked earlier about the relationships between the metals and the planets.
Right. And water.
Well, Venus is the planet of copper. Cyprus, or cuprous, Latin for copper, is named Cyprus because of the large copper deposits there.
Hmm.
And so even the Greek mythology is consistent with the metal relationship between it and the planets. Another thing that's very significant is that Venus has to do with love, beauty, it's aesthetic perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And as you may know, Venus goes around the sun 8 times for every 5 times the Earth goes around the sun. In other words, 5 Earth years, 8 Venus years.
Gotcha.
5 and 8 are very important numbers. They're numbers that are on the Fibonacci number series that turns out to be a basis of how all vegetables, all life, in fact, grows. And these Fibonacci numbers are based upon a series where you take 2 numbers, 1, and you add 1 to it and you get 2. And then you add a number each time to the one before, so you get 2 plus 1 equals 3.
3 plus
then you
2
go
plus
3
5,
plus
5
2
plus
is 5.
Mm-hmm.
5, adding it to the one before it each time, 5 plus 3 is 8, so we have 5 and 8. Then we have 5 plus 8 is 13, and then 21 and
34, et cetera. Right.
34 and 55 and 89 and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that as you go down this series of numbers, as you divide each number by the number before it, you get closer and closer and closer to a number that cannot be expressed rationally, meaning in a, you know, in simple number form, like pi,
mm-hmm.
which can't be expressed, you know, it goes out.
Goes on forever, right.
Well, the Fibonacci number series, as you go further and further out along this number series, it gets closer and closer and closer to this Greek number called phi.
Right, the golden mean, yeah.
The golden mean or the divine proportion,
mm-hmm.
which the ancients said was the holiest of all numbers. Johann Kepler, the great astronomer astrologer, said that the golden mean, he called it the divine proportion, was the number that God used to create like from like. In other words, this was the key to the evolutionary process. It was the key to growth. The Egyptians knew it. The Great Pyramid in Giza has the ratio 5 built into it as an inherent resonance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, all of the masonry works through the cathedrals of Europe are all based upon what's called the golden triangle, which is a function of the divine proportion.
Right.
And the reason why this is significant to Venus is that it turns out that the ratio of Venus to Earth is, in fact, the ratio that creates this divine proportion, this 5 to 8.
Right, amazing. If you take 8 and divide it by 5, what is the divine say? 1.618?
The number is 1.618033.
Ad infinitum, right.
Yeah, but you can just go 1.62 or 1.6 even.
Uh-huh.
It's 1.618.
So amazing. We find this ratio between the planet Earth and Venus. Hmm.
That is the ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the next interesting thing, and that is that any two planets create what's called a synodic cycle. In other words, we were talking about the new moon cycle before.
Right.
All right. Well, if you're standing on the sun, from the sun's point of view, Earth and Venus line up. And they line up 5 times
every eight years. Mm-hmm.
And when they line up, they line up 72 degrees from the place where they lined up the time before.
Okay.
72 degrees times 5 makes a 5-pointed star.
Hmm.
The only way to create the divine proportion, the golden mean, this magic ratio that defines the spiraling arms of the Milky Way galaxy, it defines the spirals inside of a sunflower seed, the petals, you know, all daisies
mm-hmm.
have 34 or 55 or 89 petals, these are Fibonacci numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what it turns out is that Venus creates this magical ratio that makes this 5-pointed star. The only way to create geometrically this divine proportion is by taking the intersections of the diagonals of a 5-pointed star. Venus actually represents phi. It represents love. It represents beauty. It represents the nature of attraction, of desire, of what we want. And as you and many of your listeners probably know, the Mayans didn't only use the sun and the moon to create their calendar.
Right, they used Venus as well.
They watched Venus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Venus's cycle is very interesting because, you know, the planets all move around in what's called the ecliptic, which is kind of like a plate. You know, it's a plane that all the planets kind of adhere to as they move around the sun.
Right.
But they move higher and lower in a very particular rhythm. And it turns out that it's like at every new moon, there's not an eclipse, because the moon is often either higher or lower in the sky than the sun as it goes across that same point.
Right, 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 right.
By the same token, Venus, as it comes between the Earth and the sun, about every year and a half, a little bit less than that, actually a little bit less than that, as Venus comes between the Earth and the sun, it's usually above the sun or below the sun. However, in a very, very peculiar rhythm, every 243 years, Venus lines up with the sun and it makes a transit. You can actually see it if you could stare at the sun
mm-hmm.
as a black dot. It makes a transit across the sun, and then it does it again 8 years later, and then it skips 121 years. And then it does it, and then it does it again 8 years later, and then it skips 105 years.
Hmm.
And then it does it, and then it does it again 8 years later, and then it skips 121. So it goes back and forth between this 121 and 105 years with an 8-year, you know, lag in between each of its two transits.
And it just happened recently.
It happened in 2004.
And it's going to happen again in 2012.
In 2012. Now, here's where I become a bit conservative, although I'm not a conservative person. I have a difficult time in knowing, in ascribing meaning to planetary transits that I have not tracked personally myself or have not observed in clients, and I have not had enough clients that were born the last time in 1882 or 1874 when Venus was lined up with the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know what this means. I just know that the Mayans tracked it and that there is a Venus transit in 2012 that corresponds with this whole other alignment with the galactic center
right.
that the you know that is sometimes considered to be, you know, so important in this whole, you know, Mayan cosmology.
Did you hear the, I'm not sure if I had you on the line or not before, but I read an email that John...
I did.
Yeah. Amazing what he just, you know, literally, you know, personally verified there at the ball court in Izapa just last week.
Yeah. No, it is very interesting.
So, okay. So, well, I'll tell you what. Let's take another short break, okay?
You got it.
And then we'll come back, and you can have one more cup of coffee or something, and then we'll have another 15 or 20 to finish things up, all right?
Okay.
All right, Rick, thanks again, all right? All right, everybody, hang in there. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we got a few minutes left here with Rick Levine after we play one more song here from Soul Valor. We've had lots of snow and all kinds of winter weather, so we'll play this one. It's called Plowing Through the Snow. And this one, again, from Soul Valor. You're listening to it on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we'll be back in just a few minutes. WKOPN Columbia Radio Orbit. It's Mike. You're listening to it here. Just about 20 minutes now before the hour of 2 o'clock. That's a song called Plowing Through the Snow from Soul Valor. And by the way, you can find information on the web about the music you've been hearing tonight at MySpace. Just click on over to myspace.com/soulvalor, S-O-U-L-V-A-L-O-R, Soul Valor. And you can find downloads of some of these songs you've heard tonight and information about Dennis, okay? And you can also go there from my website. Or from MySpace. This whole MySpace phenomenon is something else. But at any rate, Soul Valor over there at MySpace.com, all right? Okay, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We've got Rick Levine for a few more minutes. And we'll say thanks, first of all, Rick, for sticking around. I know it's really late out there in the East.
Oh, well, you know, time doesn't matter when you're in cyberspace. It's just another illusion.
It's so true, actually. I mean, it really is strange what the Internet has done to time zones and that whole idea of, like, when people are awake and when they're not. I mean,
it's not just the Internet. I mean, we, you and I, right now, are in a cyberspace. We've created a realm that is outside of the normal space-time continuum that, you know, where is here? You know, here is where you and I are right now.
Right, right.
You know, when is now? Well, it's different times, and yet we have something that we have in common, you know. So it's interesting. Again, we come back to this whole idea of how time and space are connected. You know, here's a question for you. If someone's born on a supersonic transport plane, which we don't have, you know, commercially now, but we did, you know, a decade ago.
Right.
You know, and an astrology chart is done for someone at a particular point in time at a particular latitude and longitude, you know, what time is it? And where are they?
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with a question like that from your perspective?
I don't. I've never had a client, you know, that has had that question, but they're more than intellectual concerns. I mean,
what's going
to happen when we have people born, you know, off the plane of Earth?
Yeah, off planet, yeah.
You know?
What
everything has its perspective.
Amazing. All right, Rick. Hey, let's talk about countries. Do countries have signs and futures that are written in the stars?
Yeah, actually, you know, the early astrology was not about individuals. Matter of fact, individuals were not even considered to have charts. They were unimportant. What had charts were the kings and queens, the rulers of countries, and the countries themselves. So, yes, countries do seem to have associations. Like people, countries are born into a moment in time. They grow, they mature, they develop, they conquer lands, and then they decline, and then they disappear. They die. Probably the leading astrologer on the planet these days of this particular area of study is a PhD historian from University of Bath Spa in England, and his name is Nick Campion, and he's written this. He's written many books, but one of the books he's written is called The Book of World Horoscopes, and in this book he has for every country in the world, he has the best research available on when that country was born. I mean, you know, the United States is a Cancer, is a sun sign Cancer. Why? It was born on July 4th. And yet there are charts for the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And these charts, like the chart of an individual, seems to carry the characteristics and the meaning of the country. And as you watch it unfold in time, by techniques that astrologers use to analyze the timing of events called progressions and transits, the United States chart seems to show the major events and wars and changes in currency and, you know, expansion phases, etc., just as if it was a human's chart. Then again, charts of very famous people who have passed on, their charts seem to still work even after they're dead. In other words, you take the chart of someone like Karl Marx, and even long after he was dead, you know, the rise and fall of the Russian Empire and the Communist Chinese Empire, based upon the works of Karl Marx, seem to still follow as if it was almost like his chart. It's strange how that works.
Really weird. Hey, Rick, you mentioned briefly a little bit earlier numerology and the I Ching. Do you have anything to say about either of those things?
Well, yes. I would not call myself an expert in either, although I have to admit that the I Ching was really my first love and area of interest, because I was a psychology student. I have a degree in psychology, and Carl Jung, who we talked about earlier, wrote what's called the psychological foreword to the first translation of the I Ching into German that then was translated into English, sometimes called the Wilhelm Baines translation.
Yeah, that's actually the one that I have, and I've been fascinated with the I Ching, too, for a long time. Maybe you could briefly just describe to people who aren't familiar with the book, you know, just how you use it as a divination tool, you know, throwing coins or arranging sticks or whatever.
Yeah, again, I would suggest that you put on your list of people Paul O'Brien, who is the chief visionary at Tarot.com and is maybe the grandfather of computer divination. He developed a computer simulation for doing the I Ching, which is available on Tarot.com, incidentally. Anyhow, the I Ching was originally done by tossing yarrow sticks. These were sticks that were then divided into piles that were divided into successively smaller piles that gave you a series of numbers that then were translated into what's called a hexagram, or six lines that were either yin or yang, positive or negative lines, solid or broken. And if you take six lines, each one with a positive or negative, it turns out that there are 64 combinations of solid and broken lines that can occur, from six solid lines all the way to six broken lines.
So 64 different hexagrams.
64 different hexagrams.
Right.
Actually made up of two trigrams, of which there are eight trigrams, and so it's 8 times 8 is 64.
Right.
And basically, the I Ching, sometimes called the Book of Changes, looks at time as movement. And every moment of time has a quality that has in it the changes that are inherent in what that moment of time will change into. It's not based upon the mechanical movement of planets, like the Tarot. It seems to be connected to just a way of templating or formulating that moment through a system. And yet, whether you use the yarrow sticks, or you can actually do the I Ching by tossing coins, and whether they turn up heads or tails, you can build a hexagram that way.
Right.
You end up with a reading that has one or two hexagrams, and certain lines are called changing lines, which indicate some instability. And by reading the Book of Changes, one can understand the nature of the moment of time that is somewhat different than how we normally... You see, we in the West say a second is a second, period. All seconds are the same. They're 1 second long. And to the Chinese, though, the length of time is one measurement, but time itself has a quality which is never quite the same.
Right. You know, I think, again, about science and scientism. You know, scientists are great at talking about possibilities. In other words, you know, you say, well, is it, you know, could an asteroid hit the planet? And they say, well, sure, it's possible. You know, the probability is this, that, or the other thing. But what science doesn't talk about is, out of the set of possibilities, what actually undergo what Alfred North Whitehead called the formality of occurring? What, you know, out of all this big set of possible things, what actually happens?
Right. Well, and in a way, as an astrologer, I'm always looking at the possibilities and what will happen. You know, in other words, I look at someone's chart not as a reading of what they are or what will be, but as Deepak Chopra sometimes says, I look at a chart as all of the quantum possibilities. You know, it's like waves of possibilities. And where we put our attention, what we do actually creates the reality around what these possibilities are. Fred Alan Wolf, the physicist who was in What to Believe,
right.
Fred, who is a longtime friend and actually helped me with a lot of the science behind my quantum astrology material,
mm-hmm.
Fred has this concept of called popping the quiff. The quiff is a quantum wave function. And so that things exist in the realm of possibility until it's observed, and then, pop, something happens. Now, as an astrologer, I'm looking at someone's chart as all of these quantum wave functions, these possibilities. But when I say something, when I make a prediction, I'm in effect popping that quiff, and I partake in the creation of that. The prediction is not separate from the actual fulfillment, so that when I predict something, I actually have a part in what it is that happens. I, in some cases, actually create the occurrence by my prediction.
Hmm.
So prediction is a very strange business, and it's a little bit scary because one is actually taking responsibility for things that may not be entirely theirs. Now, what happens is that the difference between fate and free will comes into play here. And there's a wonderful poem by a poet named Ella Wheeler Wilcox. And the image of the poem is two ships heading out to sea in the same wind. And one of them lands on the rocks and one of them gets to its destination.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically says it's the set of the sail and not the gale that determines the way, you know, we go.
Right.
And then she goes on to say, like the winds of sea are the ways of life as we, you know, travel along in life. 'Tis the set of the soul and not our goal that determines the happiness or strife. In other words,
wonderful.
In other words, fate is which way the wind is blowing, but free will is how we set our sail.
Wow, fantastic.
And if we are conscious, if we are kind, if we are aware, it doesn't matter which way the wind blows. We can set our sail and not end up on the rocks. But if we're ignorant, if we're, and I don't mean that as a judgment of intelligence, I mean that as a judgment of whether we choose to learn or not learn.
Mm-hmm.
If we are ignorant or if we are unkind, if we hate instead of love, we close down, and then when we hit the winds of fate, we end up on the rocks. So as an astrologer, it becomes my job to help people navigate or negotiate the winds so they know what kind of attitude to take. You know, the word attitude is used in sailing to describe the pitch of the sail.
Right, right.
And in fact, the word asana, which as a yoga posture, really the best description or the best translation of the word asana is also attitude. We assume an attitude. And so when certain things happen, often we assume an attitude because we're fearful or because we're confused or we don't know what happened or we don't know what's happening, and we end up being blown about by the winds. However, if we've practiced our postures, if we understand what's happening, we then can assume an attitude that leans the right way into the wind to get the maximum push out of that wind.
All right. Well, that's a great place to wrap things up, Rick, I think.
And just once again, it's been a pleasure being here. On my way out, I should remind people to go down to Barnes & Noble and buy your Astrology Guide 2007 or to go to Jay Widener's website, sacredmysteries.com, and check out the DVDs there, not only mine but his. And the 2012 DVD, incidentally, also has John Major Jenkins, as mm-hmm. you mentioned, and Jose Arguelles and some other wonderful people on it. So. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. It's always fun coming here.
Yeah, no doubt, Rick. I love having you. We'll do it again. We'll talk sometime in the year ahead, and we'll take another look at what's happening, okay?
Very good, Mike.
Hey, have a great remainder of the night, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good night.
All right, everybody. It's Rick Levine. One more time on the web, www.tarot.com, and also www.stariq.com. As Rick mentioned, his books are available everywhere right now. His guide to 2007 is at the front desk of Barnes & Noble. You can check it out at any of those stores, and of course on the web at barnesandnoble.com and on Amazon for sure. And the website, certainly, of Jay Widener is a great place to see some of these videos. And this quantum astrology that Rick and Jay did together really is fascinating, and I really enjoyed it when I watched it. I've watched it a few times, actually. So, anyway, okay, let's see. What do we got? 4 or 5 minutes left here. Play another song from Soul Valor to finish things off here. It's called Trip to Mean. And if you want to find out more about this gentleman and his music, you can do it at myspace.com/soulvalor. All right? Okay, it's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. Thanks for everybody hanging out. And sorry I didn't have a chance to get in the chat room and join you guys much. We were busy the whole time here, but it's been great. I love seeing everybody in there talking it up and sharing ideas and stories and websites and all that stuff. It's great to see the interactivity of the website being incorporated right during the program. So I love you guys all. Have a great new year, and we'll be back next week with a wonderful interview with Stephen Herod Buhner, one of the most amazing guys that I know, as a matter of fact. And we'll talk about plants and intelligence in nature. Okay? All right, one more time. Mike, KOPN on the web, kopn.org. And you can always find me at www.mikehagan.com. We'll talk to you next week. This is Trip to Mean, Soul Valor on Radio Orbit.